Well, that was a great discussion, and you'll see there's, there'd be a little bit of reinforcement, and I'll move through where there's some similarities in our presentations, because Donna did a great job mapping out not only generational differences, but what makes a difference to, especially the Gen X generation. I'd like to know a little bit about who's in the audience. So how many of you are Gen Xers? Okay, so that's 44 to 27. How many are millennials? Do we have any millennials in the group? Oh, yay. Gen Y, millennials. Okay, great. And then how many of you, and then, okay, baby boomers. how many of you are students right now? And, okay, great. So how many of you are like in that first 5 years of your professional life? Okay, great. And how many of you are in the position of thinking about managing and leading some of this work in your organizations because you're program director or something like that? Some of the, okay. Good, okay, nice mix. I'm gonna focus a little bit in on how we really get organizations to pay attention to developing the workforce today and some drivers for that. In our work. And, you know, John Gardner was a wonderful man that wrote a lot about leadership. And one of the things he said is that, you know, leaders are people who strengthen their people, and they will then create a legacy that will last for a very long time. And I think that you're right. When times get tough, the workers feel like they're the last part of an organization that's valued. And I think we really have to be careful about that right now. And so we need to make sure that it's not just about legacy, but it's about the importance of investing in the workforce, and it is a sustained leadership effort. Ensuring that an organization has a workforce that it needs to accomplish its mission is the fundamental role of a leader. And so if leaders aren't spending time in organizations thinking about the workforce, thinking about preparing the workforce for a turnover of some of its management, thinking about preparing its work, recruiting, innovations in recruiting, thinking about the new skills and talents that are needed to do some of the work that we're trying to move upstream in public health. We need community organizers. We need to attract some new kinds of talent. What are we going to do so those folks feel really valued in our organizations? Now, one of the problems, and we touched on it, is that there's a tremendous turnover that we're currently experiencing, but we're just at the tip of the iceberg. Next 5 years, you're going to see a tremendous number of managers in particular in all health organizations, from hospitals to public health. It's worse at the federal level. The state level's documented. There's a really good report that's out now. ASTO has it at their booth, State Public Health Workforce Survey Report. Basically about 50%, and that's shocking. You probably heard some of these figures. 50%, and it's not just management. There are aging workers at all levels of our organizations. About 50% may retire over the next 5 years. And so the challenges of our workforce environment today are that we've got the high estimated number of folks that are going to retire, but we also have a talent crunch. We have got, you Gen Xers out there are really valued workforce, and we better start letting you know you're valued, because there aren't enough of you, and we have a lot of competition for you in the public sector. And I know that it's a tough economic environment out there, but let me tell you, I think that there are going to be opportunities for you that will pick up speed here in the next 8 to 10 years. And so this issue of a portfolio of skills is very important, and I'll get into that. But there is a shortage, and I don't think it's registering for the baby boomers that there's a real shortage of you out there. The other issue is the competition that I mentioned. We have real retention problems, especially in government. We aren't keeping the bright talent that we're getting into our organizations and keeping it as long as we want. That's beginning to be a documented problem. And we're having some trouble retaining some of our older workers as well. We're not as creative in thinking about how to keep them engaged. Then there is a documented issue that, you know, some of us that would like to retire in the next 2 years aren't going to be able to. So we're beginning to document a little slowdown in the retirement. So that 50% figure might change a little bit. And then we talked a lot about the fact that we have to be aware, as many baby boomers are in management positions, about the needs and the attitudes and the values of the generation workers, which Donna did an excellent job on. So here's a little bit about the reality of the talent crunch. This is birth rate. The years move at the bottom, but you can see the peak of the birth rate that created the baby boomer generation. But the birth rate went down tremendously to create, you know, a smaller workforce to come into organizations. And then you go up the peak in the millennials. A lot of that's due to immigration. A lot of non-white and immigrants coming in and having a high birth rate. So there's a very mixed ethnic profile in all of this. But the reason that birth rate went down, think about it. Baby boomers were delaying education. We had the women's movement. We had birth control. We had all kinds of things that delayed that. So I'm sure you know of a lot of people who are in their 40s having kids and late 30s. And those baby boomers' kids now are the millennials and the Gen Xers. So all very documented, but it's a reality that we really have to think about. So this graying of the workforce, of course, is an issue, and I think that there is a lot of anxiety in organizations about the lack of preparation for turnover of some very wise and valued managers and organizations. So I'd like to know, some of you that are out there, are you like worried about a lack of preparation for people leaving your organization who've been there a long time? How many people are sort of worried and it creates some anxiety in your organization about a lack of preparation for people retiring? Okay. There are so many examples of people not being comfortable talking about retirement and giving very short notice for leaving very important positions in organizations. It's really quite shocking. And I'll talk a little bit about some examples of what's gone on in some organizations that have been very concerned about that and have started doing something about it. But there's a concern that there's a lot of, it's not just knowledge and technical knowledge, it's political savvy, it's networks, it's knowing who in an organization really can help you get that done. There's a lot of knowledge transfer that needs to really happen for people to feel comfortable that things are going to be taken care of. There will be a smooth transition when people leave, especially if they leave suddenly. So we're beginning to talk more about succession management. And it's really an ongoing process. It's not just a crisis process to get ready for a couple of key people to leave. What are we going to do? And we know, especially in the governmental sector, that you don't get to choose your successor. And we're going to talk about grooming and creating a pool of people. That's the way we can do it in the public sector. You can't tap somebody on the shoulder and say, you're going to get my job. The private sector is able to do that a little bit more. Public sector isn't. But this is an ongoing process that needs to take into consideration the agency's long-term workforce, getting the right people in the right jobs at the right time, and then think about developing skills, knowledge, political skills, networking skills, and their workforce over time. So a robust process in organizations today is development of a succession plan, knowing what, when to expect it, where to expect turnover in your organization, to identify high potentials, we're going to talk about that, to create a pool of high potentials that are ready to move up in a variety of management positions in your organization, to think about how the various ways you can develop the leadership skills of your high potentials, think about knowledge transfer activities between senior leaders that are about ready to leave and their staff in general, not just one person, to think about your recruitment and selection strategies in the organization, and then to monitor what you're doing and see what are the most effective strategies. How are you, what's keeping the younger generation in the organization? Interview your younger generation about what they need, your new professionals. So there are a lot of challenges in doing this work, especially in a time of fiscal uncertainty and crisis, but it does require top-level leadership, a long-term perspective, investment of resources, identifying what resources you can invest, and a commitment of the leadership. But there is some momentum. The ASTO in particular has done a lot of work on what our state health departments doing, and 37%, it's not enough, but they are doing some significant strategic succession planning work and thinking about different development strategies and formalizing some processes. So when we think about an organization, and you know, how do you create a culture in an organization where people are valued, where you're strategically thinking about your workforce? What are the different elements that might exist? So one is, first, and you can't see it on the slide, but you can in your handouts, yeah, having an organizational plan that says something about strategically investing in the workforce is important. If the workforce doesn't see workforce development and strategic plan, then you've lost the boat right there, because you're not even telling your workers that development of them is important. Knowledge transfer strategies, thinking about how you work with your senior people to transfer knowledge, knowing what your situation is, knowing your data, interviewing people, finding out what their plans are, and thinking about development and retention strategies. So when you think about the organizational strategic plan, that's, again, that's an important component for directing and providing the impetus for resources for this work. I'm going to talk a little bit about how to do some succession planning and a little bit more about staff development and retention resources. So when you think about developing a succession management plan, one of the first things an organization needs to do is really analyze their current context and finalize the scope of their plan. Think about how robust it's going to be. Gather their data. This does take top-level leadership working with HR and finding out if there's any magic formulas like number of years in an organization and the retirement tier that someone's in. So we're beginning to see a lot of people, you know, leave when they've got 20 years and they're in tier one or tier two retirement. So just understanding what's happening is very important. Identifying your critical hotspots and crucial positions that if someone left suddenly, it would really affect the performance of an organization. And, you know, we're not doing enough of that in our organization. So critical hotspots, and it could be it's not a management position. It could be it's a critical secretary or clerical position that's dealing with the community. If that person left, if there wasn't any knowledge transfer, that there would be a critical impact on productivity and quality of work in the organization. So in phase three, you develop your succession management plan. Think about your priorities. Again, top-level management's got to be involved. I think that all generations and all tiers of an organization need to be involved in this, because one of the things we're not doing is listening to our newer professional workers about what makes a difference to them in terms of the development activities that they would value. So one of the biggest things we have to do is start developing a leadership bench within our organizations and developing and identifying our high potentials. So what's the literature saying about how to do this? I'm sure you're all high potentials here in this audience, because you came here and you're engaged in networking and you're engaged in, you know, kind of lifelong learning through going to conferences and expanding your knowledge about what's going on in the country. So that's what APHA is about. It really can help with that. But high potentials are individuals at various points in their career are perceived to be potential successors to those at higher levels in the organization. But one of the things that the organization says, and it really points to what you pointed out earlier, is that people who show learning agility in an organization are really valued. And Gen Xers really want breadth in learning experiences, and that's exactly what we're telling management they need to be looking for in people that they want to develop. It's not just a siloed set of expertise, it's breadth and experience, and it's learning agility so that you get a chance to show how you think, how you work with others in various types of activities, not just ones that you're assigned to in your program, but you get an opportunity to work on committees, on initiatives, and have different roles in the work that you're assigned. So variety of activities, variety of assignments, and we don't do that enough in public health. Oftentimes someone's in a niche and they do the same thing over and over and over again, and really the younger generation is not going to stay in a job where they don't have a variety of assignments and be able to use their intellect in a variety of different ways. And that's not the way it was for baby boomers. Oftentimes we did the same thing for a long time and put up with it, but your generation's not. So high potential employees, and Donna covered this, so all these things, it's not about it's not necessarily about academic degrees. It's not about expert knowledge. It's about working with people. It's about political savvy. It's about showing you can manage and create a team. It's showing you can get other folks motivated and engaged. It's showing that you're flexible, that you're open to different perspectives, not just those that you came to the organization with, that you've got energy and that you get energy from others. I think this issue of energy is very important, that you have the core technical skills that you need, but also you understand how your work links to the organization's mission, vision, and purpose, and can help others see that as well. So a lot of these are different things that are different than saying, so how expert are you in just building a coalition or as an epidemiologist? These are the skills that we're looking for to move people up into management and leadership positions. So when we think about developing high potentials, we have to think about blended learning approaches. We have to think about doing a lot of different things. And I'll give you a couple examples, but these are the types of activities that we're challenging organizations today to either take advantage of assets outside the organization, like state and regional leadership institutes or other things going on in your community, or develop these internally. One is a leadership development program within the organization. Other is take a look at network development opportunities for your staff, taking them to conferences, introducing them to your network, your peers, helping them expand their network. Just being focused on that, we know you would love that, to be able to expand your networks. So we need to do that as senior professionals in our organization. Expose you more to senior management. Let you see how decisions are made. Again, these are high potentials, but how do they bang it out in a management team meeting? And how do they get from five priorities and pick one? What's the process? What's the negotiation process going on? How do they resolve conflict? How organized are their meetings? What kind of follow-up do they do? How does that trickle down? What's the communication like? All that sort of thing. You need to get exposed to the inner workings of the organization. Coaching and mentoring, which I'm going to focus on. You have to take responsibility for doing some of your own self-study and e-learning, but with what's going on, with the way you folks get on YouTube and Facebook and all the different things going on the websites, I have a feeling that we need to mine what you're learning that's going on out there as much as we need to have this two-way dialogue, because you are learning so quickly on your own with the self-learning and technology. It's incredible. Job shadowing. To be able to actually, and some of these are very low-cost things you can do to develop leadership skills. And so again, we're trying to get this into the senior management of organizations. What about a young professional being able to, we do this with interns. You'll see somebody going around saying, oh, this person's an intern with me this summer, so I'm taking them to meetings. Well, that person's outside the organization job shadowing, but we don't do job shadowing inside our organizations. What about having a pool of people that get an opportunity to do some job shadowing with senior managers in their own organization? early involvement in strategic issues. Not just have the senior team develop all the strategic issues and roll them out. As you're doing strategic planning, as you're thinking about new initiatives, pick from different levels of the organization to get people involved in giving perspective and input from a variety of different levels in the organization on a new strategic initiative. In fact, young professionals say that getting an opportunity to be involved early in new exciting innovations in the organizations is critical to their engaging in them and also feeling that they're making a contribution and being shaped by some of their needs and perspectives. And then action learning, the idea of managers not pigeonholing staff and thinking about and working with staff about what do you think you would like to do to stretch your skills? And so we talk about stretch assignments. And I would suggest that those of you, the younger professionals, if you see something happening and you know that if you got engaged, it'd give you an opportunity to do something different or to stretch because you're going to be working with new people, you're going to be using a new set of skills, you're going to be talking a different language as some part of the organization, ask to get engaged and be involved in some stretch assignments. cross-functional assignments. We have more cross-functional teams now. Matrix management is going on in some organizations, pulling from different programs to work on initiatives together. Job rotation, it used to happen a lot in the past. It's happening a little bit less, but there are examples. New York State does a very interesting job rotation program in its state health department and actually pays for people to rotate jobs. It's an amazing kind of program, but a lot of us aren't able to do it, but it's a very good way to get depth and cross-training in organizations. So I want to stop for a moment and ask, let me tell you a couple examples about, so what are organizations doing about this? Okay, in Los Angeles County, big county, but a lot of workers in a centralized structure and a decentralized structure with SPAs, special area, special program areas, and a lot of lack of communication, a lot of silos in the organization. Top-level leader wants the organization to be working more strategically on built environment, social determinants of health, and get some new thinking going on in the organization. And realize that there aren't enough people thinking outside of their silos in the organization, really wanting to see the conversation be different, see initiatives be different. So invested in the Senior Management Leadership Institute. And the reason we started with the senior level managers, and there was 120 of them, and we put them in cohorts of 30. They went through a 6-month program. They met 5 days, once a day. We wanted to break down silos in the department and realize that there were a lot of people in the organization didn't know what each other was doing. You can't get internal collaboration in an organization if people don't know each other. So one of the great things about having a cohort-based model, whereas 30 people or 40 people stay together through a variety of days, not a one-day training here and a one-day training there, and you sit with the people you know from your program and you don't meet anybody, but a cohort-based initiative where individuals are appointed, selected, compete to get into a leadership development program. There's a variety of ways of doing it. And they stay together through a learning experience. It takes them through some key competencies that you want. We did a lot of work on building teams and getting productive results from meetings. I mean, just some core things like that are very good. Time management, systems thinking, collaborative leadership, thinking about, and all these leadership programs, all the models that we have all three used have action learning as a major component, so that individuals are engaged in real-time activities that benefit the organization and are ideally vetted by the director that they want individuals in the leadership development program to be engaged in. Mentoring also, we've attached mentoring programs to leadership development in Los Angeles and Alameda County. Alameda County did a management academy. There are more examples of management leadership academies in state organizations as well. Alabama's got a very interesting team management academy. And individuals that go through these leadership development enterprises in the organizations, it is being documented, and we have done it as one of our indicators, that they are more ready to step up into leadership positions. Because there is a resistance for all the reasons that Donna talked about young workers saying, it's not worth it. That 5%, that 10% more. I see how the baby boomer manager doesn't have enough time for their family, or divorced 2 years ago, or I want the work-life balance, it's not worth it moving up. So in leadership development, what you begin to realize by working with others in your organization is that, you know, it's an opportunity to be more influential. It's an opportunity to take those great ideas you've got and to be collaborative in the way that you lead and manage. And you have to have permission by senior management too, and we do this in leadership development. We don't do leadership development where management doesn't want there to be a collaborative style of leadership in the organization. So that's a very exciting opportunity. So where you can see your ability to do things different, change things, that seems to be a very attractive to Gen Xers that want to move up. They can do it. They have a little more influence in doing that in the organizations. So what I'd like you to do is to reflect for a moment. Those of you that, of all ages, it's an appreciative inquiry process, and it's about someone watching over you, okay? Before I start talking about mentoring, I want you to think about, is there a time you can think of where someone really expressed some care and concern about your career? What did it feel like? How did they help you? So I want you to just in, or and if you haven't had that experience, what would you like to have happen related to that? So the idea of, has someone ever watched over you in your career? And what did it feel like? You want to take about 5 minutes to talk about that in pairs. Watch someone watching over you. Has anyone ever cared for you, nurtured you, spent some extra time with you? What did it feel like? And how did you benefit from it? Does that resonate with anybody? You know, it's interesting, when I was at an MCH conference, there were a number of baby boomers sat around a table and said, you know what? I don't know if I've ever felt that. And what a shame. Yeah. So I guess the thing is, have any of you had that experience about feeling watched over? Okay. Can you share a little bit about what it felt like to have that? Yeah, watching over you.
Well, I think one thing is they would tell you when you were doing good.
Okay.
But most importantly, they would say when you're not so well. Mm-hmm. And they would give you examples and kind of help you through that. They wouldn't tell you exactly what you need to do, but they would give you an example. Like one of them comes to mind and said, if you just keep going to the people who will tell you yes, that you're right, you're going to miss the whole world because you need to go to the people who will also tell you right. Mm-hmm. It's not acceptable.
Great.
That's
great. Good. So yeah, managers have to be careful too about not always appointing and working with people that are just like them. And that is a very important perspective. Let's go to mentoring, because that's one of the things that a mentor does, is doesn't answer all the questions, but actually raises questions and guides you in exploring your own muscles to develop skills at that level. Okay, mentoring is a process where an experienced individual helps another person develop their career goals and skills through time-limited confidential conversations, and they usually don't have direct responsibility for the individual. So it can be a confidential relationship. And we like to think about mentoring as being really initiated by the protege, his or herself, around getting help around their professional goals. But I'm going to talk about a few different types of situations. So when you think about a continuum of different activities, networking is primarily for expanding and sharing information. Coaching's helpful for specific skill development around specific skills like writing a budget, writing a grant, developing a team, something that has some time-limited aspects to it. Professional coaching is a little bit different, but when coaching in an organization is usually about specific skill development. And then mentoring is a longer-term venture. When we organize mentoring programs, we think about these relationships being at least a year long. Some key differences between mentors and coaches, just quickly. Mentors are usually self-selected by protégés. Coaches are not necessarily. A supervisor can be a coach. Mentoring is long-term. Coaching can be more focused on immediate, short-term, specific skill development. It's about achievement of professional goals, and coaching is about performance improvement. Mentors are not accountable for job performance. Coaches may be accountable. A mentoring relationship may include coaching, because what we do when we do mentor training is train mentors to be good coaches, like that manager was. That's a wonderful coaching opportunity to say, don't go to people that will tell you yes, go to those that will say no, and learn why, and then how to make your point. And coaching might not necessarily include mentoring, because it's more of a long-term professional. So they're very different. When you think about mentoring, you think about a variety of different opportunities for it. One is short-term, right-in-time mentoring can come by asking a friend a question, by a family member, your manager or supervisor. We do encourage managers and supervisors to, you know, get right-in-time mentoring opportunities with their staff. But a lot of you might be in a position, if you're not able to be in an organized program, of saying, you know, how many of you would like to have a mentor, by the way, right now in your career? So, how do you get a mentor, right? How do you get a mentor? And I think that a lot of young professionals are right in that middle box where you're saying, boy, I sure like a mentor, but how do I approach someone to be my mentor? We'll talk about that. And then if you're lucky enough, there are organized, structured programs. Yes? Comment?
So I just have a comment on a barrier that I've
seen. Okay.
One of my barriers is that the public health workforce is so tightly knit in Boston that I'm a little scared to have someone be my mentor because of confidentiality issues. Okay. Talking
good
things
point.
Out about people
good.
Have to work in other persons. So I'm as kind of a mentor, and I'm a little weird of getting one.
So maybe within your organization you're not comfortable. There's okay. Then you definitely need to be a part of a professional network.
Public health is a really good point, is that because we're siloed and we're like maybe short, or we may only have a small program within one small organization, mentoring within our organization is sometimes very difficult.
I have a comment. Yeah. Want, now we're at the end.
Sure.
If you're at a community agency and you're the program manager and then you have a boss,
right.
Very deep, I guess.
Right.
Right.
Oh, there's one out there, too.
Go ahead.
I know that a lot of universities are moving toward having alumni databases for mentoring. So that might be something to check with. It wouldn't necessarily be an organization. We would be able to connect to other people.
That's an excellent idea. More and more, I think, schools of public health are beginning to think about graduates being in a pool of mentors and trying to link. You do have to have somebody that links, and maybe with web technology, we're going to do a better job of having a pool of mentors that are out there that we can just tap on. You younger Precious can tap on. Yeah, Amy?
There's also the National Mentorship Program through the Student Assembly for ACHS.
There you go. That's what you wanted to say. So, do you want to say something about that?
I was just going to say it'll be using web technology to match up mentors and mentees in around specific topic areas or sections or locations in the country. So you can choose to have a mentor that you correspond with over, you know, email or on the phone, or that you get together with at APHA.
So is that going to roll out
soon?
Is that out?
If I
set up
recruiting right now because the technology is all in place.
Well, that's great. So if someone wants to know more about that, how do we find out about it?
Through the Student Assembly, APHA's website.
Yeah, it has all the links to it.
That's great. Yeah. Terrific. Okay, talked about formal and informal. So just quickly thinking about your own mentor. You need to be thinking about someone interested in your development, a role model, someone to listen to you, someone will ask you tough questions, someone's got a broad perspective, a network. You want to be thinking about one of the things that we talk about a lot with protégés is you do need to have a clear understanding of what you'd really like to accomplish in your mentoring and ask your mentor and negotiate with them. I wanted to go through quickly, think about what you hope to gain from a mentoring relationship, what kind of mentor you're interested in. It's good to have an agreement with your mentor, to think about what your goals are, over what period of time, how can you communicate with each other. Look through this series of issues because a lot of people don't think about sort of negotiating and clarifying what the purpose and role of and the needs of the protege are, and the mentor really understanding that. And the protege has to give the mentor feedback as well. Confidentiality, what you mean by that, how you define it. The mentor can help you with a personal development plan. This is an example of a framework. These are the kinds of things that mentors need to be able to do. In formal programs, we teach mentors to be good mentors. And they thank us because they go, it is different than managing somebody. And so I think in formal programs, it's very important. There are various ways of setting up mentoring programs. You can have pools. You can have one-on-one mentoring. You can do team mentoring. These are various things we've learned about mentoring programs in terms of making them successful. And there are guides available. If you're interested, you can download these guides from our website. We have one for mentors and one for protégés. And there's also state and regional leadership institutes. I always plug this because they're doing
Thank
a lot
you.
Of work on mentoring. And they are assets for all of you. Folks to send their high potentials to and high potentials to look for. That's me. Thank you.
Angie, as you come on up, I just wanted to point out in your handouts, there's an extra sheet in there that describes learning opportunities and leadership experiences. Sometimes I think people forget because they get so tuned into training and workshops and retreats and things, and they say, we don't have the budget for this. That's a big cop-out for a lot of folks. We don't have a budget. So if you think through this, this is a way where you can do a lot of things to help develop leadership in place with people, and it doesn't have to cost you a penny. Let me turn it over to Angie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Angie Denise Opiniano. I'm a second-year PhD student at UCLA with the Department of Community Health Sciences, and right now I'm also a research associate working on the Community and Child Health Network, as well as the Los Angeles Mommy and Baby Survey. I'm very honored to be here, not only because this is my first time being at APHA, but also I think this is a really important topic that's often overlooked. And particularly from our perspective, as emerging leaders, we need to think about what is it that we need and how is it that these more seasoned leaders can help address our needs. So in your package as well, I just developed a little quick handout for tips on engaging emerging leaders. And this is really developed from my own personal experiences as well as experiences of my friends and colleagues. So number one, regarding mentorship, I really feel that more seasoned leaders need to make sure to acknowledge the passion, creativity, and various interests of emerging leaders. I recently attended the MCH Maternal and Child City Match. It's an urban MCH conference in New Mexico, and Dr. Magda Peck talked about how she interviewed all these amazing MCH leaders, and the one quality that she found consistent among all these leaders was optimism. That they were all optimistic and they all maintain a positive attitude and this hope and belief that we are going to make a change, that we are the ones that we have been waiting for. And I think this is really important as an emerging leader, that we're just getting ourselves out there, that we really need to feel that we can do this. You know, and we need to feel that we are nurtured and we are mentored by those who we look up to. I think it's really important also to provide emerging leaders with guidance on immediate and long-term goals, and that more seasoned leaders have already gotten there. We're looking towards you as individuals that have already reached to this level that we're looking to get to, and we need to know how is it that we should get there? What are the steps that you took, and how can that help influence the steps that I need to take? It's also very important to maintain communication with emerging leaders. Number one is definitely being honest about the relationship that a more seasoned leader can have with an emerging leader, as well as how the more seasoned leader feels about the emerging leader. I don't know how to explain how much it touches me when somebody who I look to as a mentor or as a hero to tell me something positive, that they're so proud of me, that I just did an amazing job presenting. And that means so much to hear it from somebody who I think is an amazing speaker. And I think often over many times, many some seasoned leaders may overlook these things and think they're not as important, but it really makes a difference in our lives to continue to have that positive reinforcement, particularly from people that we really look up to. Additionally, I also think more seasoned leaders need to be sensitive to the needs of emerging leaders. Right now, I think a lot of us are dealing with these issues of how much work experience do we need to have, how much academic background. There's a lot of competition right now going on, and that we really need to consider what are the specific needs of emerging leaders. And also thinking about the diversity of the new leaders, and that a lot of us are passionate about these issues in public health because these aren't just populations that we're interested in. These are our communities and our families, and this makes a huge difference in our worlds. In regards to preparation and skill building, I think it's also really necessary for more seasoned leaders to help emerging leaders identify the skills that are necessary to better prepare themselves. And in that, I'm not only talking about public health skills, but again, this is a very competitive world, and we need to consider how is it that we're going to make a difference. We need to consider the policy aspect. How are we going to take charge with the media? How are we going to become more business savvy? How can we build social enterprises to make these differences? And right now, I do have hope that a lot of the public health institutions are changing their curriculums, changing their course requirements to enable this, but we really need to be flexible, and that emerging leaders feel that they can have these various roles and that they need these different skills in order to achieve what it is that they're trying to achieve. Networking is also something very important that I think a lot of emerging leaders right now, you know, with the whole Facebook and the MySpace thing, that's a good networking tool, definitely. But I think the more traditional networking as well, that more seasoned leaders are able to tell emerging leaders, this is how you build and maintain relationships. You need to follow up. These are the steps you need to take. These are the people you need to gain the community's trust. You need to build rapport. And again, it's these experiences that these more seasoned leaders have that can then translate to us so we can make sure that we're effective, we're efficient, and we're maintaining these important relationships. Going on to sustainability, I think it's very important for seasoned leaders to then instill in us the same responsibility that they have to us of nurturing and mentoring us, that then we can go on and be the same way with these future emerging leaders. A lot of times I feel that I've been very blessed and I've had amazing opportunities to have various different mentors. And because of that, I feel if there's anything I can ever do to help out the next generation of students, I'll definitely do that. But again, it's because I felt that from my mentors that they've always been open. They've always been willing to work with myself and work with others. And it's also very important to know that we can have various different mentors for different reasons that fulfill our different needs. And again, when we consider the future emerging leaders, whatever other generation that's going to be labeled as, we want to consider how we're going to be interacting with them. And again, I think this is a very important topic. Many of us, I'm sure, have had problems, or maybe not necessarily problems, but conflicts, and how is it that we're going to communicate? I know something that often comes up is whether or not you're going to address people by their first name, and how maybe that works with the dynamic between seasoned and emerging leaders, and that is there a level of respect that needs to be maintained from the emerging leader's perspective? And is there also the perspective from the seasoned leaders, and that they need to foster this level of making emerging leaders feel as though they're colleagues? Not only are we your mentees, but also eventually we are aiming to be your colleagues. So making sure that both ends of the spectrum are being able to talk about those issues. So overall, I think this is a good starting point. And that from here, as public health continues to broaden and we have all these new amazing leaders from various different fields that collaborate together, that this is going to be a good time for change. And this is definitely a place to start the discussion.
So I'm just going to touch upon what everybody said and kind of build from there. I don't really have anything formal here. But first, I wanted to kind of describe me. I actually think I'm a between an X and a Y generationer, because I think my mom had me when she was kind of older. So, and my sister's like 10 years older than me. So that was kind of my characteristics. And I wanted to point out how she was mentioning how there's a lot of Xers that are naive and don't respect position. But I actually think it's kind of different perspective of how we think. It's not really that we don't respect position, but I think sometimes we think maybe we can do it better. You know, sometimes like there's some people that you meet that, you know, are up there that you think you can do better, and like you said, sometimes you don't respect the like experience that they have. And I actually also had an experience at a local, a health system with the same kind of experience. And there's also, she also mentioned informality, and we think of that, we think it just makes the environment like a better place to work for, I think, instead of a hierarchy. And I really appreciated the organization I worked for, where I could talk to the CEO like he was my friend, and all the VPs, and we kind of reciprocated in that way. So that was a good example of what I had. But I also wanted to go for what I looked for in, you know, a job. And I just want to put a disclaimer, it's kind of what I think, and I'm not sure, since I'm kind of between X and Y, I'm not sure if that's what everybody else thinks. But I look for growth, and I also do look for mentoring and coaching and for work-life balance. And I think the reasons why we look for those three things is the environment we kind of grew up in. There's also a lot of travel, I think. Like now everybody goes in planes, like it's nothing, you just go cross country. Like I did, I came from Boston out here to Los Angeles. And there's also schooling, where I will be owing a lot of money. And I know a lot of people, like the baby boomers, they've told me many times that when they went to school, they paid for a lot of their schooling. So that's kind of one of the things that we look for. And on the matter of jumping around positions, we think, you know, or I think that it's something to, like she said, broaden. So I do agree with what she mentioned about moving laterally and learning more. And I actually also created some potential solutions and recommendations, I think, just off the top of my head. But I think a talent group would be really good for any organization because it'll help people mentor with each other, maybe if they're having the same age or same area, kind of in that way. And also an example of the dress code thing that we talked about, the preceptor I had, he made sure, he was like, it was a shared agreement when I came in that I like to be dressed very professionally and I don't appreciate anybody coming in with flip-flops. So I thought that was really helpful for me because I knew what to expect at that time. So I think a shared agreement, which is kind of a organizational behavior theory, would be very useful for anybody that's looking into generational leadership. That's it.
Excellent. I just would like to say how refreshing that is to hear. I remember a long time ago thinking, I think I could do this better. Does anyone else remember that? I'm not sure that's a new generational thing. I think that goes back to Donna's quote, each generation, it's like every generation thinks they've discovered sex, you know? Anyway, we've had a chance to hear from several people, and just wondering if you have some questions for our panel now. Yes.
I've got a comment. Just whenever I've sat through discussions like this, one of the things that strikes me is that the tips that we are given or that we discuss about how to work across generations or as a baby boomer working with millennials or Generation X, that a lot of the things we're talking about are sort of important leadership skills. It doesn't matter what generation you're talking about.
That's true.
You're talking about clear communication, setting expectations, recognizing the passion that people have, and being, you know, giving positive feedback, looking for opportunities to grow across a wide range of opportunities. All those things I find as a leader are important for me to use regardless of who.
That's true. That's true. Very good. Thank you.
Can I just add something? Mm-hmm. That interestingly enough, I think you're right, but it's been documented that 30% of Gen Xers will actually leave a job if they're not developed, whereas baby boomers haven't left work. So it's a little bit more of an urgent issue. I agree with you, and it's even more urgent now. So we don't have the salaries, we don't have the money, but if you get, like we had three top priorities, some attention to work-life balance, opportunities for growth, are particularly being documented in the younger population. So I agree with you, though.
Yeah, just a comment. I think when being a baby boomer, I grew up with a very defined organizational structure. Mm-hmm. OOC.
ABC.
Exactly. And the only way you were good for that organization is to keep going up that chain.
Yes.
Right? And I think now my balance is that it is more lateral, and it's not that same. Everyone's work is just as important as the other work. Just because you're the CEO doesn't mean that that level of skill development you have. I mean, the CEO, I always thought, was the most skilled at the organization. And I think now it's more spread, and you have a different home look. And so for me, that's been the hardest change. I mean, I come from a nursing model where you had a shift, you had a team leader, you had a shift nurse, and my God, you walked in and did exactly right. Well, now, for most nursing places that you go, it will be more of a collaborative where each one has a responsibility, the leadership within that clinic or that unit or wherever it is. And that's a real change, especially with people, our average is people. So it's difficult to manage people.
Yeah. Any other comments? Mm-hmm.
I had a question for, I apologize.
Carol?
Okay. You talk a lot about characteristics of good mentoring, but how would you suggest to identify them? What do you do about sort of establishing, as you said, that traditional baby boomers looked at having respect and so on and so forth. When you're young and you are very new and you're green, as they would say from the Dutch, they make those comments, how do you go about identifying mentors and trying to establish a relationship with them? And how do you set up that sort of, I guess, dynamic so that way you can then talk with them and get really good mentoring and so on and so forth?
You know what I'd suggest, because I think it's hard to do it solo, is talk with some of the other young professionals in your organization. Get together, and we found it was better to have we had 20 people in a leadership program, but it was so insightful when they just talked about, okay, what do I want in a mentor? What do I think a mentor can really get me that I can't get through a training? And by talking about it amongst themselves, they came up with some really good helpful tips for each other. Now, I think the main thing is you want to say, what do I need to learn that I value to be successful in my career? And how do you answer that question? Part of it could be, what feedback have you already gotten to date? And if you haven't gotten any clear feedback, start asking some folks, what do you think about my skills? Am I effective doing this, that? There are some, there's a good direct book out about leadership work called The Leadership Challenge. It's an easy read, and it really gets into a lot of effective managerial and leadership work. I think I'd recommend it to young professional, wouldn't you, The Leadership Challenge?
Absolutely. We use it in our institute still.
The Leadership Challenge, and it'll give you a lot of...
Kouzes and Posner. And you can get it on Amazon.com. It's an inexpensive book.
And it has some very nice large categories of effectiveness that you might will help you to reflect. So one thing is thinking about, what do you know about your own strengths and weaknesses? What do you think you need? Where do you want your career to go, you think? And what do you think others are effective in doing that are there? And if part of it is still a discovery process, then I would stick for a while in talking to a number of people about careers and about effectiveness and their effectiveness and what they learned. And you have two or three questions you ask people.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to build on that. I actually went to a speed mentoring with the student assembly at 1 o'clock. And one of the mentors, he said that the best thing to do is think of where you want to end up when you retire and then build goals from there and then go out and kind of network with people, right? And I thought it was helpful for me to ask like three simple questions that I think everybody asked, and it was really helpful. One was, how do you get here? How did you get here? Like, what experiences and what education? Two, what's the greatest thing that you've learned in your career? And three, what was the hardest thing that you've had to do in your career? So I think those three kind of sum up like a lot of people's strengths and weaknesses that you could pretty much use in your own career as well.
Thank you, Julie. We're coming to the formal end of this session. I'd like to close by sharing a story that I have about one of my many public health mentors. I worked as an executive secretary in a division of community health services in the state of Utah. And my boss was a nurse, and they're very effective at mentoring. And I was at a challenging position in my life where I had sort of reached a plateau where I could not go any further until I had some kind of at least a baseline degree. And I was very much like you, saying, I know I could do a better job than at least half of the people I've been working for because I do their work for them anyway. And I was very stuck where I was. And I was going through a personal life change where I was going through a divorce, and I was suddenly a single mother. And my nursing director called me one day, and she said, you have no more excuses. You are going to start college next semester, or you're not going to work for me anymore. It was a tough love approach. And she was the person who finally got me enrolled in college. I graduated less than 5 years later, working as a single mother. 2 months after we had that discussion, I was promoted into my first professional level position. And things really skyrocketed for me after that. But it was because she pushed and made me take that step out on the edge and step off of the precipice and not only say I could do it, but show that I could do it.
And throughout my career, this woman still keeps in touch with me. And with every great success, she succeeds with me. And even though she's 88 years old now, I still get a few calls every year from Adele saying, "How are you doing? I felt like I needed to call you to see how things are still going." It's made a huge difference in my life, and I think that's the kind of thing that you just cannot put any other kind of value to, that kind of a relationship. And there are people out there who will do that for you. I liked what you had to say, too, about it's a pay it forward. Someone did this for me. Someone did this for her. We need to be doing it for you now. Thank you so much for attending our session today.